Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears along with you on this Thursday, October the 22nd, 2020. 10:22:20, 17 minutes past the hour. We thank the Daily Beast, Eleanor Clift, for joining us in hour number one to talk about everything going on in the world. This hour, we have got a great guest. I believe he has been on this program two previous times. He is probably the most well-known defense attorney in the history of modern times. You probably remember him best for defending such high-profile clients as O.J. Simpson and Sam Shepard right here in Ohio. And I believe during one of our conversations about Sam Shepard, our guest mentioned that he had visited Mr. Shepard in the Marion prison, which is still here in Marion, Ohio. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones for the third time, and hopefully not the last, the legendary F. Lee Bailey. Mr. Bailey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
It's always good to hear from you.
Thank you. I'm always glad that I'm able to talk to you, because it means I ain't died yet.
Well, we're all happy for that. I want to start here, Mr. Bailey. I talked about being a defense attorney. What makes a good defense attorney?
Oh, a bunch of renegade ingredients, but it begins and I think ends with a profound belief in self, and that is that you'll be able to pick the right causes and then have the energy and the wisdom to see them through to a reasonable conclusion. We don't always find the pot of gold, and not every place is Cinderella, but we'll problem solve it. And if we improve the client's lot substantially, even if we don't get the brass ring, that's usually the level of satisfaction that a good, experienced criminal lawyer can expect.
When you are a defense attorney, do you have to believe your client?
No, not at all. But if I don't, I'm going to give him a cross-examination like he'll never see in the courtroom until he tells me a story I can believe. You know, that's an old chestnut. If you stop and think about it, it has no logic. Now, the sneaky part of it is, if he doesn't tell me he did it, then I can put him on the witness stand and let him lie, say he didn't do it. But that is not within the canons of ethics. If you have good, solid reason to know there's your client or any other witness is lying, you do not put him on the witness stand. It's suborning perjury, just like some crooked prosecutor did it. If you don't have the truth out of the client, you're in no better position to get him a positive maximum result than a doctor is when you go in and say, my leg hurts, when it's really your right elbow.
You know, when you are involved in high-profile cases, much like Sam Shepard was, much like O.J. Simpson was, when you're involved in those cases and you know people are going to be writing about you in newspapers and talking about you on television every day, in those particular cases, do you have to believe your client? Does it mean more when it's followed so closely?
Well, believing the client has to do with the manner of defense. I did not mean to intimate that I would turn a case down simply because I found my client's guilt to be reprehensible. Now, I did do that one time, but four guys had gang raped a young girl, and I just couldn't sit in the courtroom and think of a single decent thing to say about them. They were brutal. But those cases have to be defended. If I got appointed to defend them, as I did in that case, so I talked my way out of it, am obliged to go forward, what you're not obliged to do is to corrupt the system in order to produce a not guilty result by illegally covering up evidence of guilt. Much more important to me, much more typical of my practice, I get the case where not guilty is not enough. If you don't clear the client, that is, get the general public to accept the fact that not only is the proof against him deficient, but he didn't do it, then you have stopped short of the mark. And it's tragic. And there are two classic cases in history where that happened. The client was acquitted, and a majority of the public ran around convincing themselves, even though they had watched the trial, that he was really guilty. One was the trial of Lizzie Borden in Fall River, Mass. In 1926, and the other was the trial of Dr. Sam Shepard in Los Angeles in 1994.
To this day, Mr. Bailey, and I know we did a whole show on this, Sam Shepard looms in Ohio. He is no longer with us, obviously. But people still debate his guilt or innocence. Why do you think that is, long after his passing?
Same reason as Shepard that O.J. is not getting a shake. The press, and in this time it was much more tightly controlled and focused on the Scripps Howard empire, and I'm talking 54 when the murders of Marilyn Shepard occurred, took attack right from the outset, said, look, damn it, this man is guilty, and you cops and you coroner better get out and put him in jail. Now, that's not why we created newspapers. They're entitled to opinions and things of that sort, but when they deliberately intimidate public officials, including judges, into running the courts in a corrupt way and getting corrupt results, which happened in Shepard, they're way outside their boundaries. And I told this to Louis Seltzer to his face in the early 60s, and I think he took that unpleasant thought with him to his grave. Once again, in O.J., I was in the courtroom. I saw the evidence. The blood evidence turned out to be really inauspicious. It didn't show anything. It had defects all over the place, from being planted to mishandled, to being mixed, to not being sorted out into separate samples. It was just terrible. And yet, the press informed everybody there's a mountain of blood evidence, and therefore, that means he did it, no matter what the jury says. And then they insulted the jury. So, while I am not a supporter of Donald Trump, he's got one thing right. The press sometimes are not as careful as they should be when they're attempting to relate important human events.
Yeah, it's very interesting because the media certainly has become front and center during the last 4 years, the presidency of Donald Trump. As you say, you're not a supporter of President Trump, but you understand his quandary with the media. In 2016... did you support President Trump or candidate Trump at that time?
No.
Why do you support Joe Biden in this election?
Well, I do because he's the only other guy that you can support. I like Joe Biden. I think he's a decent human being. I thought his deceased son was a decent human being, and I suspect, although I don't know him, that Hunter is a decent human being with a few personal problems. But I would give Joe Biden all the money I had and ask him if he'd take it across the Potomac, and I believe he'd get it there. Because his word is good. He values his word, and that to me is the most important ingredient. When you stop telling the truth and you hold high office, then the whole structure shakes. And unfortunately, I don't think President Trump is always out there trying to lie. I think sometimes he just forgets what he said last week. And he forgets what he did last week. And therefore, the same event is described this week in different terms. By the way, before we skip away from it, I first met Dr. Sam Shepard in Marion, Ohio.
You know, and before we get, I want to come back to the presidential election here in a moment, but because Sam Shepard is so important, when you met him, only knowing what had been in the press and that he had been incarcerated, was incarcerated when you were meeting him, what was your impression of the man?
Now I've got you. Because you suggested that I knew very little of the case. You know, my life is one of flukes combining with flukes and creating fluky results. I was teaching at a school that taught lie detection in Chicago. Only those aspects of the profession that had to do with legal questions. Paul Holmes was a lawyer, an eminent Chicago crime writer for the Tribune. And he came to the school saying the Shepherds would like to find a lawyer that knew something about the lie detector. And the president of the school says, well, there he is. He's the only one in the country that I know. So Paul asked me if I would fly to Cleveland and meet with Sam Shepard. And he gave me a copy of his book, The Shepard Murder Case. And I was a reasonably, for a young guy, sophisticated defense lawyer, because I'd tried a lot of cases in the military. By the time I landed, I was satisfied that Sam Shepard could not have killed his wife. And when Steve drove me out to meet him, by the end of a short meeting, I said, Sam, I'm going to get you out. It's going to take a little time, but I will do it. And he was goggle-eyed. I came to be a believer, and it took me 2 years to get him out, and two more to end the case.
It certainly was one of the most interesting trials of certainly Ohio history, maybe if not the most interesting. Coming back to the presidential election, we talked about the president's honesty, which you have a problem with, but all re-election campaigns are referendums on the current president's policies and the way they've handled things. In the last 40 years, we've only had 2 one-term presidents, Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush. In your opinion, for F. Lee Bailey, why is President Trump not the guy to go on for 4 more years?
Well, he had brought some misfortune on himself, to be sure, but he had not lived in the best of times. For instance, one can hardly hold him accountable for the origins of COVID-19, but on the other hand, one can reasonably be critical of his unwillingness to face the seriousness of the problem and to begin to call the fire department out early on. Nonetheless, it's a monster, and who's to say anybody could have really curbed it in its early days except a small country like New Zealand, which is so far down south that the virus probably couldn't find it. Not necessarily. What a terrible thing in the economy, because people couldn't go to work. And as they transferred that part of their work that they could to their homes, it was slippages, so the government printed up a bunch of money and shoved it to them, and it gave the appearance that the economy was all right. Well, free money tends to give that appearance. We gave the government a lot during World War II in the form of war bonds, and the United States got rich. It worked out very well. So that hasn't been handled too well either. I think the lack of clarity on a stand on racial prison preferences has been just another slop in an already unpleasant bucket. So on those three issues, I think he's got a lot of hoops to jump through. I also think that a lot will depend on tonight. He has been told, look, you didn't do a good job. You overtalked and shouted both your opponent and the host, neither of whom are turkeys, and deserve more courtesy than that. And so maybe we'll shut the mics off when it's not your turn. And his latest has been, my voice is good enough, I don't need the mics. I can shout over and talk through his mic. That doesn't sound to me like an acceptance of the rules.
What do you foresee happening tonight? Last debate, less than 2 weeks till the election. President Trump is behind by most accounts by double digits. What does he have to do tonight to turn this around?
He's going to try to ride his Supreme Court nomination, which is about the only horse he's got in the race that's traveling forward. The other three are all going backwards. So, doesn't have much. Conversely, he will attack Hunter Biden as though Hunter Biden were Mephistopheles, unleashed and capable on his own of overthrowing the United States and all things that are decent. So that will be the two prongs that I think he leans heavily on. I predict he will begin in a somewhat taciturn state, but lose control, and once he gets irritated, I think there'll be some over-talking. Kristen Welker might be the wrong person to do that to. She is a tough, experienced, very attractive reporter, and I think sympathies for her be much greater than they were for Chris Wallace, whose dad was an agent provocateur, albeit a star reporter. And I like Chris and think he's a strong guy, but he's not warm fuzzies. And by the time you get nasty to Kristen Welker, you're going to be halfway in before you realize what a bad mistake that was. And then generally, it's tough to get out. So Trump has to win it in tonight's debate, in my view, and it's simply a bridge too far.
Mr. Bailey, this is a question I've been waiting to ask you for this particular reason. Certainly, I would say, and I think anybody would say, that in the last half century of electronic media, there was no more watched examination piece of a trial, more watched, or ever will be, than your cross-examination of Mark Furman during the O.J. Simpson trial. Now, a lot of this had to do with race. And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you felt that Mark Furman was racist. Is that correct?
Yes, and I didn't have to establish that. I had his own voice and with some filthy declarations, which didn't reach the jury, nor did they need it. But certainly it reached the public, and people had to listen to some awful things about their race, whether it was African Americans or Jews. For instance, Amy Comey. Barrett just been approved by committee. Pick me back up where we were, because that flash on the screen intervened.
Yeah, we're talking about Mark Furman and being a racist.
Yeah, Mark Furman said that he thought all black people ought to be gathered together and burned. That's a fairly racist statement. He didn't say so publicly, but he had a horrible prejudice, which he expressed in various places, about Jews. And indeed, on his mantelpiece in his home, he had a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf with the spine facing out, so you couldn't miss the cover title. It was a fellow with an awful lot of problems. My job was to show that his improbable story about finding the glove would have to be measured up against some demonstration that he would lie under oath. That was my objective. I did not know when I dove in, although frankly I had a lot of witnesses to start with. I did not know anything about the tapes. If I had, I'd have had to turn them over to Marcia Clark, and the surprise element would have been gone, although I'm not sure what they could have done about it. But I just sensed in Mark Furman the kind of guy who, if you had the right kind of bait on your hook, would snap at it, and he did.
That being said, and a lot of that is fact and a lot of that is opinion, because of the George Floyd case and everything that's happening in this country this past summer, that has been brought up in this election. And certainly it is no stretch of the imagination, it is no doubt, that people have called our current president a racist. In the first debate, Joe Biden called him a racist on network television. I don't believe that's ever happened in a presidential debate. For somebody who's cross-examined a man who you felt was a racist, do you feel President Trump's a racist?
I think that's far from clear. I think in pandering to what he views as his base on the right wing, and correctly so, that is his base, that he believes that condemning white supremacy is going to cost him votes, whereas commending it or tolerating it isn't going to cause as much damage. I knew Donald Trump vaguely before he ever ran for president. I knew of him as a businessman in New York because he was building the Grand Hyatt when I had an apartment there. And I met him in Mar-a-Lago soon after he bought it. I never picked up anything generic that suggested down in his heart of hearts he was a racist. And furthermore, I think he has treated black people most of the time pretty well. He was criticized far more for being mean to young, to small businessmen and not paying their bills when he went for bankruptcy. And women, his record with women amazes me because they just keep coming back for more. Some of the things Donald said that aired on TV were enough to enrage the average conservative women. And yet conservative women say, oh, that's Donald. Okay, let him go. That offends me.
We know this time from this conversation that your vote will be with Joe Biden, but with less than 2 weeks to go, notwithstanding any huge happenings, who do you think will win the election on November 3rd?
Well, you know what I think is damn near irrelevant. This is a business I suffer through like most people. I watch political ads all the time. My head is pounding. They always say the same thing. They always say dumb things. It's just a season you have to go through. But if I defer to those who are in the business, who keep their noses to the ground, and particularly to the voters' state of mind, I would have to say that right now, Mr. Trump has been laboring a war, and if he does nothing but hold his ground, Mr. Biden is probably going to take it. And I'm with Rupert Murdoch. I think it could be a landslide. If enough bad things happen in the past 3 days, because the race gets desperate and the language gets fouler and Trump gets more aggressive and works up a backlash, he could lose by 200 electoral votes and be a strong candidate for the worst president in history, and I know that troubles him.
If that were to happen, and Joe Biden were to become president, Donald Trump would leave office on January 20th, 2021. Now, this has been a big question. You cannot indict a sitting president. And there are charges that people like Michael Cohen have went to prison for, been released, but have went to prison for, in which we think President Trump has been named, but nothing could be done, Southern District of New York, because he was president. Do you believe that Donald Trump, the second that he is no longer president, whether that's in a couple months or in 4 years from now, will be brought to trial and could possibly face jail time? That's never happened with a former president other than Nixon, and he was pardoned.
No, Nixon was never prosecuted criminally as such. The pardon was in place before the charges were brought. But to that extent, you're correct. Andrew Johnson was tried strictly on impeachment charges and not criminal charges. Whether or not the president could be tried for offenses committed, and I think there are some out there, for those offenses, once he loses office, is a question that's going to be answered. I personally think that with a Supreme Court that he has composed largely on the one hand, a President Biden would say, why keep this country in agony for another 3 or 4 years by bringing him to trial? He's 76. So he does a couple of years in the can. He'll put up a cat fight and raise enough money to keep it going, probably till he dies, and the United States will stay in turmoil. And I say that in part because when Leon Jaworski was the special prosecutor, took over from Archibald Cox in Watergate, I was up to my ears in that case in several respects. And I got wind of the fact through Gerald Ford that Jaworski was thinking, maybe it's a bad idea to prosecute Nixon. Maybe we need to wrap this up and put the country back together. And I agree to that. I told President Ford that. And I would probably tell President Biden that. You know, there's been a pound of flesh. He gave you a hard time over it. But you're the bigger man to say, I told you so, and get him a criminal sentence hasn't really helped the U.S. Indeed, it keeps our laundry out of the line for another 2 or 3 years, and I don't think our laundry line looks very good. It's been kind of a mess for most of this term. Every time we hang it out, something dirty shows up.
When we turn to the Supreme Court hearings are going on right now for Ms. Coney Barrett. A lot of people are worried. Affordable Care Act, there's a trial coming up, a case coming up for that right after the election. Roe versus Wade since 1971. People feel it's in no greater danger than it would be now. Should this justice, or should this judge, should this be going on right now, period? Should this hearing a month before the election be going on?
No, I think that's terrible. And I think it's terrible because Mitch McConnell made himself one of the smallest men on the planet. Says, we can do it, but you can't do it. Having snuffed out a hearing on a perfectly legitimate candidate and quite a nice man, Garvin, 4 years ago. McConnell then turns around and says, well, that would have been 9 months. We're going to jam this down your throat in 3 months. And why is he saying they're doing it? Because we can. Now, I sincerely hope that when the smoke clears, there's a new face coming out of Kentucky, because I think Mitch McConnell has done a lot of harm to the Republican Party and the country, and that nomination should have been pushed off until after the election I think she'd have gotten a lot less grief over Roe v. Wade and the medical question, the insurance question, if it hadn't been shoved down the Democrats' throat at the 11th hour when they're all trying to run out and get reelected. It was pretty unfair to them and to the Republicans that had to give up the time whose seats were in jeopardy. Now, let me flip that over. I think that Barrett will not be a disastrous judge. Roe v. Wade, in my opinion, is going to still be the law when I pass away. I'm 87. I'm going for another 20 years. You'll still have that one on the books. As far as Americare is concerned, or Obamacare, she has said one thing which, to me, says it all. If there is what is called severability, that is the law with several provisions, is attacked on one of the provisions, which is then struck down, does the rest of the law fall with it? And the law, particularly in the Supreme Court, is perfectly clear. No, the doctrine of severability applies, and if the mandate that has been struck down, the only thing so far in Obamacare, stays down, that is not going to take the rest of the statute with it. And she has said she recognizes severability. Therefore, I don't think she comes into the court with any sledgehammers on new cases.
Very, very interesting. O.J. Simpson is still a figure who people have a lot of interest in. Now, he's certainly had a low profile since being released from prison the time he was in prison, the recent time. Have you talked with O.J.?
Oh, a great deal. In fact, I will give you a great anecdote. I don't like to use that word great so much. I'll give you an interesting anecdote about the day he was released from prison, if you'd like to hear it.
I would love to hear it.
The prison people, after the parole hearing, could see, and they're way up in the sticks of Nevada, Lovejoy, I believe, is the name of the place, which is a little bit odd for a prison. But that's where he was. The warden said, "My Lord, we don't need to have a convention of newsmen here. Just open the gate for O.J., but that's what we're going to get." So they called O.J. and they said, "You get a very good, trusted friend and give him these GPS coordinates. It's a logging road some miles from here. And we'll deliver you there at 2 a.m. And he better be there and he can take you home. You'll be free. He should be able to miss the press." And so O.J. called a good friend of his, whom I know and think a lot of, named David Furlong. Now, David was reluctant to go, even though O.J. is a good friend, because he had a big swinging party he was planning to go to at the Mandalay Hotel that night. O.J. was persuasive. David went to the woods. The three friends who would have been in his party at the Mandalay Hotel all got shot.
Good
time to be picking up your friends.
Wow. What a story.
Yep.
My goodness.
Well, I talked to O.J. a couple of days ago. I'm in fairly constant contact with him because I'm coming to the end of a book about him and his case. And when it comes to, you know, third reads, to get everything that you can, as close as you can, to the facts that reporters will find if they dig into it. In other words, they pull a fact check on me the way they like to do on the presidential debaters. I want that thing to shine because it's been 25 years in the making.
I certainly don't want to pry into your personal conversations, but you say you talked to O.J. a few days ago. We don't hear much from him. He doesn't do interviews. What kind of things is he interested in today? Is he following this presidential election? Does he have a favorite? What does he talk about?
I don't think he makes as much in politics. O.J., since I met him before the murders ever happened, briefly, does not bother him so much with external things. He's required, was when he worked for Hertz, to grant him people he's never met before and have his picture taken with him and play golf with him. The fact is, he lives a very normal life. His neighbors treat him wonderfully. He's really popular. When he got out, they gave him a nice house to live in and a used Bentley to drive, which he still has. I visited him at his house with his neighbors. His kids have a great relationship with him. So for a guy that got kicked all over the parking lot, I'd say that he's landed on his feet.
Do you have any impression of the way he would vote?
If I did, I think I probably wouldn't discuss it with you, because that's kind of a private matter. I certainly would want to call and say, OJ, in Marion, Ohio, where they happen to have a fairly clean prison, they want to know how you would vote. Now, if you give the wrong answer, you better marry it.
You know, Mr. Bailey, the thing I've always wondered is, and I can certainly understand why he wouldn't want to do several interviews, but my goodness, we'd all love to talk to him. Why doesn't he do interviews?
He has been burned a couple of times on that. One was the book, If I Did It, which was a vehicle to raise money for his children, so they could get through college. Well, bound up, the book was a disaster. He got conned. No money was ever paid. The book was pulled from the shelves. Now, he is living under a bankruptcy judgment that's good for another 50, 20 years. So, although his pensions are exempt from being recovered under that judgment, everything else is gone. If he were to get money for sitting down, talking with you and all the other people who would like to interview him, it would be taken right away from him. If I were in his shoes, I wouldn't do it. I mean, newsmen are fun to talk to when they come in droves. Being fun part recedes a little bit, but still, my business, I think, requires that I give them some time and cooperation. His business does not. And frankly, after the way they treated him during the trial, I would have trouble finding it in my heart to sit down with a guy who called me 8 times a jerk and a killer during the trial and have him give me that nice, warm, fuzzy interview.
That very well could be certainly a valid argument. This is a story, we've got about 5 minutes left in the interview today. This is a story that is of high interest, has nothing to do with politics, but would just love to get your take on it, because for a lot of people it's life-changing, and I'm going to read it as we have it so I don't misquote it. Pope Francis became the first pontiff to endorse same-sex civil unions in comments for a documentary that premiered Wednesday, sparking cheers from gay Catholics and demands for clarification from conservatives, given the Vatican's official teaching on the issue. This is what the Pope says in the documentary. Homosexual people have the right to be in the family. They are children of God. You can't kick someone out of the family nor make their life miserable for this. What we have to have is a civil union law. That way, they are legally covered. That's Pope Francis. That's just yesterday. What do you make of that, Mr. Bailey?
I read it, and I think it is not extraordinary. This has been coming. The Supreme Court recognized civil unions long before the Pope did. And so he's not doing anything new. He is backing down a little bit for the Catholic Church as a whole, because he can't win. I'm not sure he's happy about it. Catholics have spent so many years denouncing same-sex marriage. But, on the other hand, the Catholic Church, like any other political body, keeps an eye on its membership. And if that becomes dwindling because its ideas are out of time, and they certainly are, then it's time to cave in and change at least the expression of those ideas deep down in his hassock. Oh, they feel it's a terrible thing. But he speaks for the church, and I think it was a smart thing to do. And I think probably it's not totally unrelated to the fear that the Catholic Church has that even though there are quite a number of Catholics there already, that Amy Carr might be knocked out because she was Catholic. And I'm sure the Pope loves her stand on Roe v. Wade, which she made very, very clear back in the Seventh Circuit. I also think that he doesn't want to alienate a bunch of women, and she's got a sterling track record. She's adopted a bunch of kids, and this is not an easy candidate to muck up.
And before we part ways today, there's just a question as a human being I have to ask you, the same question we're all dealing with right now, certainly in the United States and other parts of the world. As an 87-year-old gentleman, what has COVID-19 been like for you?
Well, it's very troublesome in all but one respect, and give me a little more time to work on this book, which I've been at for 4 years, but with my finger and 85 other pies, it's been tough to pull it together. Other than that, it's taught me a lot about the society around me, sometimes to my astonishment. When people promise, march around, wanting their lack of masks, kind of reminds me of burning bras. I mean, look, Ma. No hands, see my bicycle get out of the street. I'm not chicken. And this crazy idea that you're a real tough guy if you will stick your neck out in the face of a virus as vicious as this one is, which we don't even understand yet and have no remedy for. I think it showed me different people in different lights, but if I had to classify it, my friends right now, there would be a reclassification depending on their attitude throughout COVID-19.
When we look at this, when it's all over, when it's in the rearview mirror, in the great stories of the 20th century, maybe the great stories of the United States, and I'm not talking about great as in good, I'm talking about great as in big. Where does this time place with wars and assassinations and September 11th? Where does it fall?
It is but another example, and I think when it shakes out, another commendable example of something Admiral Yamamoto said when his men were cheering, having just come back from what was thought to be the annihilation of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. They were celebrating, they were popping the champagne, and Admiral Yamamoto said, "I fear that all we have done is to waken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." And I feel that World War II, Osama bin Laden, the Cold War to a less extent, and now certainly this virus, 9/11 to be sure, certainly this virus is just a test of the resilience of the American people, and it's a tough test, baby. The toughest so far. But we've got enough population, so quite bluntly, we can suffer a great decrease and still be strong, and somewhere along the way, we're going to find a way to put a bottle on this virus. We're doing it under tremendous pressure, but we'll come up with something. In that, I have confidence, because I've watched American science attack one insoluble problem after another, and yet here I am talking to you on an instrument that weighs less than a pound, hundreds of miles away, with the clarity of a church bell.
Mr. Bailey, we got 1 minute left, and I want to do this very quickly. I'm going to give you four names, and I just want you to give me one word that pops in your mind when I say these names. Okay, the first name, Dr. Sam Shepard.
Screwed.
O.J. Simpson.
Screwed.
Joe Biden.
Good man.
President Donald Trump.
Troubled.
When I think of the law since I was a child, I think of F. Lee Bailey. What a pleasure it is for the third time to talk with you, and I want you to come back often. It's been too long since we've spoken, and if you're ever talking to OJ and he wants to do an interview, you know, maybe this wouldn't be an awful place.
Maybe it wouldn't.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Stay well.
Okay.
Bye-bye. The legendary F. Lee Bailey. How about that? Probably the... Whether you like him or hate him, for the people he's defended, probably the most well-known defense attorney in the history of modern times, and probably the best. Sam Shepard, ask O.J. Simpson. Guess what? Glenn Coble's coming up next.
First spot. We are on every Tuesday at 5:15 and replay again on Wednesday at 3:15. We take pertinent issues of the day going on and look at them in a biblical perspective. So we'd love to have you listen and just, you know, call in, just get a conversation going and have a great time on the show.
Pastor Steve Whitaker is the pastor at Community Christian Fellowship in Prospect, Ohio. Address 209 East Water Street. This is Scott Spears, high above Marion in the WWGH News Chopper. If you see news in Marion, please email us at scott@wwgh1071.com and keep an eye out WWGH News Chopper